everybody, and welcome to Grim Scenarios. We are going to be continuing with our strategy tier list. We're still working on minions this week. And, of course, I'm your host, Milk, and with me, as always, your other host, Emma. And, Emma, do you want to kind of fill them in on how we're ranking these? It's not exactly by power of the token.
Yeah, we're not really ranking by power or even by fun. We're trying to rank by the strategic depth the character provides to the game. So what do we mean by that? We mean sort of the choices it enables players to make, the different things it can do effectively, the optionality it gives you in how you approach the game, the various different things you can do with it. And we are also considering, like, its strength and fun level as, like, subparts of strategy, but we're trying to make most of our focus be on that sort of strategic depth of the character, the optionality, the variability, the things you can do with it.
Yeah, something I thought about since the last time we worked on this is that, you know, every minion, to some extent, just has the option to double-claim another character, you know, has the option to out evil and, you know, play this sort of aggressive mode.
And know, also simultaneously to be socially good and sell and try to play that. Like, we're not looking at that. We're looking at the sort of strategic choices the token and the ability gives you rather than the strategic choices you get from being an evil player in a game of blood on the clock.
Yeah. Some minions might be more willing to be out at evil. Some minions might be more inclined to try to hide their presence. Some minions might be more willing to let their exact role be known. Some minions might hide that. That's somewhat more about what's in the token itself, but we're really looking at what is, you know, kind of what is the emergent strategy that you can kind of create based on what the token does, what the ability does, and what it empowers you to do.
So. Yeah, so just to recap where we left off, we considered Goblin and Baron S tier for strategy, for this sort of exercise, Devil's Advocate, Assassin and Marionette A tier, Serenovus Fearmonger and Godfather B tier, Evil Twin, Harpyian Mastermind C tier, and Mazephiles, despite its intense power level and frequently fun to play as, just doesn't have much strategic depth in its ability, so it's down in D tier along with the Boom Dandy, which has similar problems.
Yeah, and we discussed all that last time, so let's get into our next minion, which I believe, Emma, is the Organ Grinder.
It is the Organ Grinder. The Organ Grinder's ability is, of course, that it causes voting to be eyes closed. What does that mean? It means that the good team doesn't know who's voting on who, nor does the evil team, because they have to close their eyes as well. And they don't, importantly, people don't know how many votes are they have.
The monkey can also not die by execution unless it votes on itself, so it does have some execution protection built in as well.
Yeah. We're going to cover, actually, I think, three of the inbuilt execution protection characters today. Organ Grinder, Psychopath, and Vizier. DA obviously also has execution protection as a minion, but it doesn't have to choose it to use it on itself, whereas Psychopath, Vizier, and Organ Grinder always have that execution protection on themselves.
Yeah, and I think that's a good and a little bit more subtle starting point than talking directly about the voting element, the voting, you know, the blind voting element of the Organ Grinder. Because really being able to survive execution in some way is both a strength and a weakness for a minion. It's a strength in that it allows the minion to stick around and keep their ability in play for a while. It's a weakness in that if you can be identified as being a minion, it probably means the demon has to spend a kill on you at some point to get you out of the game, because good's just not going to be looking at you. But
But it also gives you the benefit of the good team can't kill you, so if they're not killing other evil players, you can just sort of brute force an all-evil final game state.
Yeah, and I think of the three inbuilt execution protection characters, Organ Grinder, the protection is the hardest to find, right? Because the voting is hidden, and so it can be tricky or require a few attempts at execution to get to kind of narrow down to an Organ Grinder. Mm-hmm. So of the three, it's the quietest in being protected, I would say.
Yeah.
And I think that gives it some, I think that gives it some strategic value in choosing when it wants to go, although it's very apparent when it does go out of play.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and that's sort of where I was going to also direct our conversation if you didn't get there first, Bill. The Organ Grinder's ability to choose when it goes, and the fact that, especially in a two-minion game, in two-evil games, so under 10 players, which is... In the online community, we sort of think of 12 as a default player count, but it's important to remember that the game was originally designed with the idea of 7 to 9 players, and sort of 10 to 12 was a additional rule set that was grafted on, and then 13 plus from there to make it work with bigger player groups and player counts, but 7 to 9 was sort of the core design mode of Blood on the Clock Tower. So, in one minion games, if you get down to two people who might be the Organ Grinder, there's no option for the all evil final three, obviously, in two evil games, the 7 to 9 player count. Bounty Hunter and Mez aside for release characters. Ogre, I guess, as well. So, like, the idea of trying to brute force the all evil endgame doesn't really exist in the 7 to 9 player count, and in that player count, the Organ Grinder is, if it can be identified as not a demon, or even if there's two players who can be identified as not a demon and possibly the Organ Grinder, the Organ Grinder is likely going to die in the night. So the Organ Grinder has much more interest in killing themselves at the time where they think the demons would kill the other Organ Grinder candidate anyway, to keep it ambiguous about which one is the Organ Grinder and which one is the framed good player being framed as the Organ Grinder.
Yeah, forcing the evil team to kill someone who is clearly not a demon candidate, and that not necessarily
sorry,
being...
Milk, sorry.
Oh, no worries. And that not being who the evil team wants to kill in that moment can be really detrimental. And so the Organ Grinder really has to figure out when it's time to kill themselves off. They can... You know, if you kill yourself off in the day, you can sort of frame whoever dies at night that night. So if you have some, you know, you can maybe kind of make it. But it's very clear that the Organ Grinder is out of play and that an evil has died. And so that's kind of the challenging part with the strategy of Organ Grinder is how long do you hold on to it? And I think part of that is also being aware of how suspicious town is of you and how suspicious town is of the demon. If you're kind of going under the radar of as the Organ Grinder, you might be able to leave it pretty late. You might even be able to stick around in final three.
Yeah. If you're an Organ Grinder who people think might be the demon,
yeah,
you should absolutely be staying alive till final three. Because then it, not only will people be maybe executing you as a demon candidate, the votes will also be secret, and they won't. And that makes secret votes are much easier for evil to move or tie.
Yeah. So, where do we think Organ Grinder belongs, Emma? I think there is some interesting strategy to it. It's not exceptionally versatile.
Yeah. My inclination is to put it in the A tier. I don't think it's quite as strategically deep as the Goblin or the Baron, who I think are so deep, but I don't think it's as... It's obviously not as one-line as Mez or Boom Dandy. It's not as limited in what it can do as Evil Twin, Harpier, Mastermind. It's not as limited in what it can do as the Serenova, Fearmonger, and Godfather. So I feel pretty comfortable slotting into that A tier with our friends the DA, the Assassin, and the Marionette.
Yeah, I think either high B or low A tier. It's certainly somewhere in that kind of range. And it largely can depend on the game size. It largely depends in some ways on what it's on the script with as well, and how kind of the players are kind of reading it. But I do think in general it's an A or B tier minion strategically.
I would strongly push I think for A. Like the Organ Grinder the Organ Grinder's like need to figure out whether it's a demon candidate or not. and then make the choice in whether to die accordingly is, I think, more strategic depth than what the Serenov of Spearmonger and Godfather are trying to accomplish.
I think that's probably right. All right. That brings us over to the Pit Hag.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably we're going to agree that on Sects and Violets specifically, so on its home script, the Pit Hag has a lot of options. There's a lot that the Pit Hag can do. And it's often played in a not very interesting strategic way, in that it's often just played as sort of, okay, let me turn some stuff into minion, into let me turn some townsfolk into outsiders, basically. Let me make some outsiders. But I don't think that means that it's not a strategically deep and interesting character. One of my favorite things to do with Pit Hag is to turn people into less useful townsfolk. So for example, turning people into homework roles, like Town Crier and Flower Girl, after they haven't tracked the information the day before. I always find that quite funny. If you have a philosopher out of play, you can make your fellow minion into an evil philosopher and let them drunk a role in town. That's a pretty interesting play. And it does, of course, allow you to move the demon, which is important in Sects and Violets. It allows you to become the demon, mm-hmm. which is important in Sects and Violets. But all of that really requires you to do a lot of investigation and a lot of understanding what's on the Grim and who is useful to change out of their roles. I think it's an incredibly powerful role that also has a lot of versatility and strategic depth, but it takes a lot of knowledge to be able to use it well.
Yeah, so I think this is the first time we've brought this topic up, so I do want to talk about it a little bit. I think the Pit Hag is a minion, more so than every other minion out there, that is constrained by the meta it finds itself in. The Pit Hag meta is so heavily bent to make outsiders, turn your demon into a fangu, make an outsider for them to jump to, that doing anything else, like, flags that the Pit Hag is the type of player who does other things with it. Especially if you're messing with a good team. So the Pit Hag's, like, the power of the Pit Hag to create, like, good minions and good demons, as you mentioned, creating evil philosophers, evil snake charmers are really powerful because they can move the demon without a signal. There's lots of evil townsfolk that are powerful, especially off Sects and Violets. We didn't cover Boffin with the other B at the front of the alphabet because it wasn't released yet when we recorded that episode. But we'll probably address Boffin at the end of this episode as well. Boffin is really emphasizing how powerful some townsfolk can be in the hands of evil in certain game states.
And Pit Hag's always been able to make those, you know?
Pit Hag's always been able to make those. But again, Pit Hag is really constrained by its meta. Like, when I think of the games I play, when Pit Hags start creating evil minions, or good minions, when Pit Hags start changing people from one townsfolk to another, I'm like, okay, here's, like, the three people who aren't me who would do this with a Pit Hag. Let's kill one of them. Because they're the only other one playing the game, and I know I'm not the Pit Hag in this particular game.
Wait, I'm in that list! That's not good!
Right. So,
that's not good for,
like,
me!
I don't really know how this cuts for the Pit Hag, but the Pit Hag meta is so constrained by the supposedly dominant Pit Hag strategy of make an outsider, turn your demon into a fangu, have them jump to an outsider, that doing the off-meta stuff with a Pit Hag ends up outing who the Pit Hag is a lot of the time. Like, I've talked with this a little bit with Nate, good friend of the podcast, former guest host with both of us, Navian. Like, we're both the type of people who like making good minions, mm-hmm. like making good demons. But when we do it in our games, people are just like, oh, Emma's the Pit Hag, Navian's the Pit Hag. Like,
yeah.
So that, like, sort of forces even the people who would use the Pit Hag more creatively into conforming to the meta of outsider, turn your demon to a fangu, jump. So I think the Pit Hag, and I don't think Pit Hag is the last character we'll talk about, how its strategic depth is constrained by the meta, But I did want to emphasize that here is like the powerful, interesting, strategically curious things that a Pithead can do are limited by the fact that the meta is so strongly against that. With that said, silent Pithags frequently dominate games.
I'll just cut in really quickly. Silent Pithags dominate games, but don't feel like you have to be a silent Pithag to be powerful. Something Emma just pointed out about that meta of make an outsider, turn your demon into a Fangu. Right? Let's just think about Sex and Violets. Make an outsider, don't turn your demon into a Fangu. Reveal one of those outsiders, and now you've got a town that's hunting for outsiders.
Yeah.
That's hunting for a Fangu, while your Nodashi just sits peacefully and quietly off in a corner somewhere.
If you really want to be clever, have your demon sink the kill to fake the Pithag demon change.
Mm-hmm.
So it really looks like you're following the meta and creating Fangus. Obviously, if you can find it in non-off-sex environments, you can find, like, extra evils through a Mazephles, a Bounty Hunter, an Ogre. Trying to think if anything else released creates extra evils, naturally. Without causing the player to be dead. I don't think so. You can... Turning those into townsfolk is really powerful. There's some townsfolk who it's incredibly destabilizing to make evil... especially because there's no signal to the good team that it's happened. Virgins, if you can pithag someone on your team into a virgin, pithag someone into your team into a goblin, a golem, a night watchman, a gossip. On a script with like a damsel, you can pithag another minion into a dreamer so they can go damsel hunting.
Don't forget...
a gambler can go damsel hunting.
Also, don't forget that you can... use your ability to discredit someone.
Mm-hmm.
Making someone into a different role multiple times. Like you get to that end, like you've pithagged some people. And then you get to the kind of toward the end of the game and you don't necessarily have something you're really interested in making or your team doesn't need you to make something for its strategy. Just pithag the same person you've pithagged before. Pithag dead players.
Mm-hmm.
Like do some different things to see what you can do to manipulate the town into your world, because that's ultimately your job. I mean, other than looking like the demon and getting killed, which is every minion's job, right? Part of your job is selling your world. If the pithag's doing weird stuff, you know, they're gonna look at people like me and Emma again, you know.
I guess where I'm going to land is, because I think the Pithag is so constrained by its meta, I feel like I'm forced to slot it into B tier here. But I would love to see a world where the Pithag meta changed, so players had more freedom to explore the more zany depths of Pithag strategy.
I'm going to push against you, and I'm actually going to say I think it still belongs in A tier, because I think the potential is there, right? It being constrained by the social meta is not a problem in a game where everybody is within the same social construct, right? I mean, in some of the games that we play with other friends, the TPI games, for example, right? The person who pithags people into demons could be like five or six people. And at that point, it's sort of freed from that constraining meta.
I think even in those games, I'd be able to identify the pithags who were being weird.
Maybe. I do think there's enough versatility and enough potential in it that I would put it in A tier.
We can slot it in A tier.
Which is where I'm gonna put it. Because I do think there's a lot of choice. And I think depth of choice, options for different types of strategy, options for different types of actions, that's what makes characters, you know, strategically interesting in some ways.
Yeah. I
don't disagree with you that it's constrained by the meta.
It's so constrained by the Pithag meta. You're so outed as a Pithag if you play off meta, which is a real bummer.
So we would encourage all of you, our faithful listeners, to go out there and break that meta for us so that we can do crazy stuff with Pithags when we want to.
Yeah. Next up is the Poisoner Milk.
Oh, Poisoner. I want to love Poisoner. I really do want to love Poisoner.
Oh, I think Poisoner's great. I think Poisoner is easy S tier for me. If you don't 100%. Think that, so Poisoner. Poisoner is another minion who's really gains value from figuring out what's going on with the game. Right?
Agreed.
It's a minion who really enjoys working with a Grimkeeper, much more than I think demons do.
I also agree with you. Yes.
Without a Grimkeeper, a Poisoner, who figures out what's going on in the game state and figures out how to A, hide that it's a Poisoner game, and B, find the right people to poison at the right time, is so rewarded for their decision-making, more so than almost any minion. And the nice thing about Poisoner is frequently it only takes one good key poison at the right moment to swing the game towards your team. So you have a lot of runway to like make your random poisons night one and night two. And then by the time you have the information with the Grim you need on night three, make that key poison, get the really important information out there for you.
And I think from my perspective, the thing about Poisoner that I find that gets lost a lot is that the work that you have to do before day three to get that key poison, or the work that you have to do to make that key poison, isn't necessarily being done. And so the information doesn't get to the Poisoner. And often in the late game, even on Trouble Brewing, I see Poisoners that there's not really a lot of places for them to poison. And this comes, again, from partially a meta thing, which you and I have talked about in the past, of needing to leave people alive to be demon candidates and not just saying, oh, look, a fortune teller, I'll kill that. Oh, look, an empath, I'll kill that. Oh, look, an undertaker, I'll kill that. And killing off all of the things that could be so much more useful if they were poisoned and left alive.
Yeah. A fortune teller who is poison locked by evil is so much more valuable for evil than a poison fortune teller who's dead. Like, if I can get a living fortune teller to tell me all these people are the demon, these people are the demon and they're not the demon, instead of being a dead fortune teller who has a yes on my demon, oh, that's beautiful.
And the struggle for me, I think, and maybe it comes from the perspective of having story told so much Trouble Brewing, is I often see that poisoner put in the work and then get that poison on the perfect person on day three. And then on day three, the demon kills that person. And so the information that was perfectly poisoned to misinform the town never goes out. And this is a result of the fact that poisoners and demons need to talk. More than many other minions, poisoners need to be in contact with their demon. And I think a lot of players are afraid to have regular like catch-ups and pre-plan things. Played a wonderful game recently where Sabanite, I was the demon and Sabanite was the poisoner. And I told Sabanite from the beginning of the game the exact order in which I was going to kill players. And Sabanite went out and found the people that needed to be poisoned and went and poisoned around my kills. So we didn't need to touch base again because we had kind of talked out where the kills were going to be going in the game. But unless you can do that, unless you can work together in that way, and Sabanite and I have played a lot together, so we kind of have a sense of each other and how we play, you know, and we both listened to the town square talk and we both could have adapted if something was changing. It's really crucial to understand that you need to get back to your demon and let them know when a crucial poison is going to be better than a kill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just something that often I think players are a little hesitant to kind of go out of their way to make that communication or try to signal to each other. Oh, signaling to each other in town square. Oh, I love my heart sings when I'm storytelling a game and I see a poisoner signal to their demon in the town square and the demon gets the signal and then you go and talk to them in the night and they say, oh, the poisoner I'm pretty sure is poisoning them, so I'm going to kill over here. Oh, the best That's so great. It's so rewarding when that strategy kind of pays off. But for the poisoner to work, evil has to be in communication. And that's a core Absolutely. Piece that I think is lost a lot with this specific character.
Next, we have the psychopath.
Wait, and, let me throw it up there in S tier.
Let's not put it in S tier.
I need to put poisoner in S tier. Yeah, I had to, forgot to put it up.
Oh, well.
We both agree.
Whenever I think about the psychopath and strategy, Milk, gosh, I realize our viewers are probably so young, they don't understand the memes and references they should. So, and we're sort of doing this as a mostly audio podcast, so hopefully we'll be to stick in the particular meme I want here. But Milk, you're like me, are old. So you probably remember early 2000s, beloved cult comedy Arrested Development.
I am familiar with early 2000s beloved cult comedy Arrested Development. Yes, I've seen the whole thing.
So, so there's this wonderful scene, and I don't want to suggest that I am attacking open relationships or polyamory. I'm not doing that. I'm just using this scene for a point. because the scene... you have two characters on Arrested Development. Tobias Fünke, a aggressively closeted homosexual psychologist, and his wife, Lindsay Bluth, who hates him and married him to make her father angry. And they're talking about their completely disastrous marriage. And Dr. Fünke says, sometimes his patients will come to him and suggest maybe if they opened their relationships up, it would fix their falling apart marriages. And Lindsay asks him, well, did it work for their people, these people? And Tobias responds, no, it never does. I mean, these people somehow delude themselves into thinking it might, but it might work for us. And that's a long runoff to say, please don't just sit there doing nothing as a psychopath for 5 days in the hopes that it might work for you to kill the last good player in Final Three without anyone knowing you're a psychopath.
You're not an assassin. You're a psychopath. Swing that axe, baby. Swing that axe.
It doesn't work for you either. You're deluding yourself into thinking it might work for you, but it isn't going to work for you. As the psychopath, your job is to slash people with your axe, speed up the game, use your minion ability to help your team by making it harder for good team to gain and collate their information at the cost of eliminating demon candidates.
Mm-hmm. And that is a big cost, by the way. You are eliminating demon candidates. So much like many other, much like what we were just talking about with Poisoner and Imp, you need to be in communication. You need to be paying attention to who makes a better demon candidate. Like you can't just go crazy choppy choppy on everybody who has an ongoing information role. That's not going to work.
Yeah. I like to start my psychopath games by immediately killing someone at the dawn of day one. You don't have to do that. But it's just a reminder to myself that my job as the psychopath is to throw axes at people until and accelerate the game.
It's an intimidation your minion factor ability, too, right?
You like, have it.
There's an intimidation factor to it too, right? Like, it's putting town on notice that if you give out information to the evil team, you're getting chopped.
Yeah, you're halving the game speed, essentially. Mm-hmm. You're doubling the game speed. You're halving the number of nights the town has to get their information. You're halving the number of days the town has to pick up information. And you have a 67% chance of living anytime you're executed. So on average, it's going to take, I don't actually know how to do this math off the top of my head.
It's going to take two.
It's going to take two on average,
maybe more.
Three, sometimes four or five if you're really lucky. And if good spending 2-3 days executing you, that's 2-3 days they aren't executing your demon. Yep. Like, all that's gravy.
Or demon candidates, by the way. It's not just your demon you're preventing them from executing. It's demon candidates that you're not chopping.
Yeah.
So, and even if they kill you, even if you chop somebody and they kill you on day one, you're an assassin that killed someone and absorbed a kill. That's pretty good.
Like with other killing demon minions, you're very rewarded for learning stuff about the Grim. It can be harder as a psychopath sometimes because, for some reason, good players don't want to share things with you. But much like how good players can get reads from what outed evil players are saying, when they know the outed evil players are likely lying to them, outed evil players can get reads from what they know good players are saying when they know that the good players are almost certainly lying to them.
That's right.
So it's mutually beneficial for psychopaths and good players to talk to each other and try to get reads off what the other one is trying to get out of that conversation.
And it might be okay to hide a psychopath for a day. You know, your mileage may vary. Don't necessarily think that you have to chop someone every day. But in general, you're going to be better off just chopping and chopping and chopping.
Milk is just wrong here. You should be chopping someone every day. I will put my foot down here and say I think Milk is 100% wrong. Chop someone every day. Chop, 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 chop. I don't think this reduces your strategic depth either. The chopping, who you chop is the strategic depth. It's this, you have the baseline strategic depth of any demon, which is figuring out who to kill on a daily, on everyday cycle. Like, that's what, that demons normally have more strategic depth than minions because they have to make those calls. Psychopaths also have to make those calls. and chop, but I do think you need to chop every day. Like, use your ability to accelerate the game. Don't slow it down. Don't let the game get slower. Time is in good's advantage. Your role as a minion is you get to eliminate time. That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. I do think there's some circumstances where it might be worth holding it for a day. You should never hold it for more than that, is my take on it. I think that especially there are circumstances with things like Poppy Grower and Magician to some extent, although you could still just chop your way through those problems. That's not really an issue. But I do think there's times when you just don't have the information to make a good chop on day one. And if you're not going to just randomly chop, if you're going to use a different approach, then you might be able to get more information on day two. You might have a bluff or something that's useful to sort of push to day two. Your mileage may vary again. I generally agree with Emma that you should chop basically every day, but I mean, once you've chopped, you should chop every day. If you want to hold off for a day, I can see some strategic value in that. But I think the important thing in what we're talking about here, less than specifics of our disagreement here, and I don't know it's that big of a disagreement, is I think Psychopath has a lot more strategic depth than people give it credit for.
Yeah. Knowing who to kill, figuring out who to kill, with the constraint that good players are going to lie to you because you've been chopping them every day and they know you're a psychopath, really, I think lots of strategic depth there.
Yeah, I think it's certainly that's B tier.
I would say B, and I would say high B. I think it's higher than Sarah or Fearmonger. Assuming you're playing it correctly as someone who chops every day. If you're going for the never get executed, never chop, get to final three, it's like D tier. Like,
it's very bad if you're not.
You've picked a strategy that has no decision points and is bad for your team. But as long as we've gotten that out of our systems, as long as we understand it won't work for us either, it's a B tier minion.
You want to be chopping as much as possible, and you want to be absorbing executions as well. That's what makes Psychopath strong. It can chop and it can absorb executions. So you need to be doing those things. So B tier it is. Scarlet Woman, I believe, is next, Emma.
I think it's your turn to go first.
I am all for it. All right. Scarlet Woman is... Scarlet Woman is challenging because Scarlet Woman is so valuable to the evil team as a fallback in most situations that it's often forced to play a very safe, very, very, I am a townsfolk, here's my information, I need to make my information sound as true as possible, I can sell out my demon, I can sell out the minions, try to look as good as possible kind of game. And I think it gets stuck there to some extent because evil teams tend to value it so highly as a fallback. However,
yeah, I
played in a game recently a game of Pies Baking. I played in a game of Pies Baking recently where I was the imp and I nominated the virgin on day one and then went ahead and pushed on my Scarlet Woman and got her executed. And in the process of that, we wasted a lot of town's time with me looking like a marionette, potentially, with me looking like I was maybe the drunk, and with her claiming soldier. It was Bunny, of course, and just really sowing a lot of confusion in the town. And I think when you start to think about Scarlet Woman as only a fallback, it starts to lose the strength of being a minion, which is to say all of those great things that minions can do outside of having an ability, Scarlet Woman can feel constrained from those because of its ability.
Yeah.
If you treat the ability as a fallback and not necessarily as like the Scarlet Woman has to stay hidden, has to be, you know, protected by the evil team at all costs, I think it becomes a much more interesting strategically minion to play. I think the ability becomes more interesting when you realize that it doesn't really matter when the Scarlet Woman catches it. It's okay for evil to be suspicious of... It's okay for evil players to be suspicious. It's okay for the Scarlet Woman to be suspicious. You don't want to catch it and then die, but on TB specifically, you can catch it and then star pass and throw it to a third minion. One of you's got to be less suspicious, right? I mean, in the game I was mentioning, nobody was. We were all suspicious, but, you know.
Yeah, I think with the Scarlet Woman, the strategic value of letting your demon being able to be executed is pretty high. And I think the strategic value of letting your demons kill themselves in the night and pass to you if they're not an imp is also pretty high. I think the Scarlet Woman is another character that's somewhat constrained by meta, which is to say, I think the Scarlet Woman really benefits from taking the survive long time bluffs. Soldier, Mayor, Ravenkeeper, Saint on TB, which also have the benefits of, on other scripts, like, that may have chambermaids, like match a Scarlet Woman's wake pattern. Like, these characters both... the Scarlet Woman's desire to seem socially good, which it does want to do, it's in many left incentivized to seem socially good as backup, like, gives it a desire to fall into those bluffs that don't require the Scarlet Woman to get into conflicts with good players, which is something normally I think you'd prefer to reserve for a demon to avoid getting in conflicts with good players. Whereas with the Scarlet Woman, sort of wants to take that away from the demon in its role as a backup. But this also means, like, a Scarlet Woman sort of has to frequently, in games where the demon doesn't have to die, if the demon is also looking socially good, if the demon's also around towards the end game, the Scarlet Woman suddenly has to pivot from being the good one to being the evil one on a dime, which is a very tricky thing to pull off a lot of the time. I think basically it goes with the other two TB minions we've looked at, the Baron and the Poisoner. I think it's really high up there in terms of depth, though I do think it's somewhat constrained by its meta in a more way that the Baron and the Poisoner are less constrained.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. There's a lot you can do with it, but you have to not be afraid to have the Scarlet Woman get killed. Like, you just have to be not afraid to lose that resource, just like any other resource. There's an amount of risk that you can take with that ability. There's an amount of, okay, it doesn't really matter which of us dies. And in that sense, there's a lot of fun strategy you can have in terms of the Scarlet Woman and the demon pointing at each other, right? And when you kill off the demon, maybe they look like a minion and the Scarlet Woman looks like a good player. But it's a very fine line to walk. You really have to do a lot of prep work for that to kind of work. You can't just start throwing accusations at one another and assume it's going to happen. It takes effort. I think this is probably high A tier, somewhere around.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Assassin or DA, in that kind of assassin DA
yeah.
area.
I'd slide it up to the top of A.
Yeah, sure. I'll put it at the top of A. right above the assassin. Where are we next? Spy! You know, we're doing these alphabetically, and I don't know if that's the best way to do them, but I guess we'll just keep doing it this way.
It's an organization method. I'm fine with it. The spy. Statistically known to be the weakest Trouble Brewing minion by far.
Yep. Two parts to
Grim
the
Knowledge is very overrated. the spy's sort of other ability is passive. The misregistration is passive, which means the spy has limited control over it, other than, like, the same way any minion can tell the demon the story, can indicate to the storyteller what they want to be seen as. If someone's going to get wrong information on them, they can do so.
I think this is a good spot for us to talk about why we don't consider Grim Peaking to be super valuable. Because I think people who are first coming into the game and first looking at TB, they look at the spy and they go, wow, the spy is so powerful. They get to know who what everybody is. That's incredibly strong for the evil team. So why, I guess from your perspective, Emma, and I can share mine as well, why is it that Grim Peaking isn't necessarily something that's overwhelmingly strong?
Yeah, sure. So there's sort of two parts to this. First of all, is sort of naturally in a game of Blood on the Clock Tower, if you're trying and you're paying attention, you'll be able to get most of the Grim from the good players by day one or day two. The spy will let you see through certain lies the good players like to tell, but like those lies tend to be pretty predictable. So in that sense, like knowing you, it's like sort of just like giving the evil team the information they were going to get by day two or day three anyway, a day or two early. It's fine. It's just not particularly special. The second thing is the spy sort of having that grim knowledge too early can sort of trick demons into killing based off how strong they think the townsfolk role is, rather than the social situation of the game. this isn't to say the spy is pointless or worthless. I think, like I noted, the spy like is a major power up for the poisoner in particular. Knowing where to poison is much more useful for the poisoner than it is for the demon, who I think should be eschewing killing based off roles most of the time. They should be killing based off the socials of the game and who looks like demon candidates and who doesn't look like demon candidates. But the poisoners want demon candidates to look as bad as possible, including have the worst information as possible. Mm-hmm. And the spy helps poisoners a lot. The other sort of weird thing about the spy, and we'll get back and let Milk answer this question too, is the ability to seem to read to good players' abilities as good can be counterproductive for the evil team's goals. Like, think of like a 7-player game where the spy is sitting next to the empath with a good player on the other side and the demons over on the other side of the grim. The spy can register as good to the empath, but then the empath has just eliminated two demon candidates on by themselves, which takes the demon candidates available for the evil team down from 6, 5 of them who aren't the demon, to 4, 3 of them who aren't the demon. That's like a drawback a lot of the time. So you really want... So like, it's just a weird ability, is what I guess what I'm saying.
I think from my perspective, and I'll go back and answer the other piece of it as well with regard to Grim Knowledge, but I think something that's interesting and that some of our listeners may not be aware of is that there has been some the rules for where spy should go in the Knight Order are in theory consistent, but where it's actually happened has bounced around a little bit. And I'm growing more and more of the mindset that the spy getting the Grim before townsfolk abilities activate might be really important because it might allow the spy to tell the storyteller what they kind of want to happen. I think that's somewhat useful. And the spy communicating how they want to register in general, if they, you know, what they are kind of doing. I think the spy benefits a lot from kind of being able to communicate with the storyteller, which is something you can do in online games much more easily than you can in person, although you can still do it in person if you go and have a, you know, ask the storyteller a question or go have a little storyteller consult there on the side. But I agree with Emma in that knowing the Grimm is something that you can have within a couple of days. I do think that the value of the spy's ability to misregister might, Emma pointed out that it might be bad for the good team, or it might be bad for the evil team, because it makes the spy not a demon candidate. I think it's interesting because it's almost like the spy is like a poisoner that can hit someone before the game and disrupt their information. So it's almost like a hyper-accurate once-per-game poisoner, in a way, that can eat a librarian ping, that can eat a washerwoman ping, you know, that can disrupt that start knowing information in an interesting way, especially in Trouble Brewing, where you might want to fake a barren world, and a spy could be shown to a librarian as a third face-up outsider. So if your storyteller's clever and thinks about what they kind of can do with the spy's misregistration, you might get something pretty interesting that you can work with, but it's very dependent on sort of what the storyteller sees on the Grimm and the spy's willingness to kind of communicate and ability to communicate with the storyteller. It's definitely a weaker minion in a lot of ways, though.
I would encourage, like, on Trouble Brewing, if you have an unlimited time to look at the Grimm, or your storyteller, at least in person, is going to be doing nothing else but standing there with the Grimm in you.
And please indicate to your storyteller, especially in person, that you need more time with the Grimm. You do not have a limited time with the Grimm. You can't sit there for 20 minutes, but genuinely, if you need a couple more seconds to look at the Grimm, indicate to your storyteller that you need some more time.
You are, I want to emphasize, allowed to look at the Grimm for 20 minutes. I don't think you should, but you're allowed to.
Yeah.
But what I was trying to, what I was trying to get to is like, say you're in like a washroom and Ping is the spy, and you see that in the Grimm. Like, take your character sheet and point at the character you want to be seen as in that Ping. Like, same for a librarian Ping. Like, you can tell the storyteller this. And they can do it, and they should do it if you communicate with them. Mm-hmm. If I send you a Grimm online and you respond with a message saying, show me as the recluse, please, to the librarian, I'll do that. Like, you can communicate with your storyteller as the spy during that Grimm peaking stage, and it's fine. Do it. That's it. I think, like, the spy doesn't get to make choices. The choices the spy gets to make are...
It's fine. You know, get some extra buffs. You might be able to do something interesting and some, you know, again, off Trouble Brewing. Maybe you can do something interesting because you have some start knowing. Maybe you can make yourself look really good and then catch a star pass. You know, there's some stuff.
You can do super interesting stuff with a cannibal as a spy. But I think generally it probably goes down in C tier.
It goes
with Evil Twin, Harpy, and Mastermind.
I'm going to put it above Mastermind for personal reasons.
All right. Next up, we have the Summoner. The Summoner is what I call a quasi-demon, in that for the first 2 days of the game, the Summoner is effectively the demon, in that it's the player good needs to kill to win the game. And then on night 3, it chooses someone else to take that responsibility off its hands. So, Milk, what you got for me on the Summoner?
In a weird way, it's like a reverse Scarlet Woman. It's a minion that doesn't want to be killed in the beginning of the game, and then later in the game can be disposable, which is sort of the reverse of Scarlet Woman, which can be disposable earlier on potentially, but once it catches the demon, obviously, it doesn't want to be killed. We've been talking a lot about choice. You know, we've been talking a lot about how choice empowers strategy and the ability to sort of be versatile and do things and make interesting choices Well, the summoner makes a very important and very big choice on night three, you know? And I think in a lot of the summoner games that I've played, I've found that it takes quite a bit of prep work on day one and two for a summoning to be really effective. And then the summoner really has to do a lot of work after that to look like the demon, to be suspicious, to try to misdirect. And also, you have to onboard a demon on day three, which is, or two, if you're in a Pukka game. But you have to onboard a demon very suddenly. And all of a sudden, you're handing the reins of your evil ship over to someone on day three. And I think it's fascinating. And I think there's so many choices involved that what ends up happening is people get a little bit strategically overloaded. They tend to get a little bit stuck, and they'll often default to a player that they know a lot about in terms of like game in-game knowledge versus going for something a little bit more unknown. And I think if I could encourage people to maybe play into the unknown and spend more time on their first day or two, especially, you know, there's just two minions, so you can really have some time to kind of set up, you know, especially if there's two minions, you have some time to set up kind of how you're bluffing and really set up to be able to make that play after day three once you've kind of summoned onto someone. I do think there's a lot involved with Summoner, and I think there's a lot of decision points. One big one, but I think there's a lot that goes into setting up that decision.
It's another minion that really rewards getting a good sense of the game state the first 2 days. And using that sense of the game state to predict the player who's most likely able to get to Final Three as the demon. And part of that is, to do another pop culture reference, this time to The Princess Bride, is good's probably going to solve it's a summoner game. So they know that the summoner is going to try to be finding the player who they least suspect is the demon. So good will then reverse. So this creates a layered situation, as in the scene of the poisoned wine goblets in The Princess Bride, where you want to be the one who ends up winning the battle of, I know that you know that I know that you know that you're trying to trick me.
Yep. And that's quite a lot of fun. I mean, that's really fun, and it's a very interesting strategic decision. In theory, that the summoner has to make, but even, like, you know, getting feedback from your other minion, like, having conversations with people, even to the point of offering to summon onto someone. Having the other minion do it, maybe. Like, have the other minion offer to summon onto someone and see if, you know, see if they're game to join the team. There's some stuff you can do that's really, you know, quite a lot of depth there, I think.
So I'm going to advocate for putting the summoner at the very top of S tier in terms of strategic.
I agree 100%. I was going to suggest that as well.
The summoner makes the most important choice in the game, who is going to be the person who gets you to the end game. Like, it's very highly rewarded for understanding the game state very quickly. It's highly rewarded for predicting how other players will think about a summoned demon, and like I said,
choose
it's making
what demon to bring into play if there's different options. I think there is value in thinking about that. I think there's value
there certainly is, but I just think it's less important to what makes the summoner the single demon with the, like, most strategic depth, as the social understanding of the game state, the social read of who people are going to want to kill
for sure
once they've solved its summoner game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of layers, and I think there's a lot of decisions that a summoner has to make, and I think you have to be really very fully engaged in the game to be effective as a summoner. So I agree it goes to the top of S tier, and I think it's one of the most interesting and fun and absolutely engaging minions in the game.
Next up is the witch.
I think you'll find that you've skipped two.
What have I skipped?
Vizier and Widow.
Oh yeah, I'm completely out of order here. Next up is the Vizier.
Oh, Vizier. My favorite.
The Vizier is, of course, the third and last of the released. Everyone knows you are who you are. Everyone knows you're in play if you use your ability, and you get execution protection as a result minions, along with the Organ Grinder and the Psychopath. It's the one who has absolutely no choice in whether they're going to be outed evil or not. They are simply announced as an evil minion at the start of the game. So, whereas the Psychopath can make the wrong choice to not be outed evil, the Vizier has no such choice. They will be outed evil. Absence and alchemist
upgrade.
Stuff.
And oh boy, is it interesting to play the town off one another with votes and who you decide to execute, when you decide to push a kill through, when you let somebody not, when you don't push a kill through on somebody. It requires you to have a great social understanding of the game. How many good voters is too many? How many good voters is not enough, right? It's all great.
Yeah. Of course, the one thing the Vizier can't do is execute their demon, because then they lose. So you do have to be careful to make it not obvious when you're not executing your demon.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very similar to the Psychopath.
I agree.
I think much like the Psychopath, the Vizier should be trying to use their ability most days. Most days, they should be directing the execution of town. You should try not to let days go through where executions happen without your permission.
If the town nominates who you want to execute, right, and puts a whole bunch of votes on them, just let it go, right? Because you don't need to push it through and confirm that that was an execution that you wanted, right? You can play those games.
I would genuinely try to execute, use your power to execute every day as the Vizier. I think most of the time you want to do that. I think you should save good players.
Absolutely.
Let other good players vote on them after they're on the block.
Yeah, you have to.
But I think your goal should be use your power to execute every day as possible. You're probably going to have to be killed in the night going into Final 3, that's fine. Unlike the Organ Grinder, you're not going to be bluffable as a demon candidate, so most of the time you will die in the final in the night, which is fine.
Yeah, I think this
sacrifice
goes
other minions, especially.
Yeah,
kill them. Don't cry about it. They're meat shields.
Yep, that's their job, and you can't be sacrificed off as the demon candidate, so somebody's going to have to be. This goes at the top of B tier for me for sure.
Of B tier. But
yeah, I was just putting it with Psychopath, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll put it below Psychopath. I guess I'll probably put it below Serenovus as well. Yeah, it goes somewhere in B tier. I'm not sure I can rank the tiers individually.
All right. Next up is, of course, the Widow.
We already gave the Grimpeaker spiel. We're not going to repeat it here.
Yeah, the Widow obviously has slightly more active choices to make than the Spy, in the sense that it has to make a choice at the start of the game on what character they most want poisoned. And for that reason, I'm going to ignore the Widow's ability to self-poison.
Yes.
If you self-poison, you're just a much weaker Spy. I'm going to ignore that ability.
I don't care that it exists. I don't see
the value in it.
There are very few, and I mean very few as in like 1 in 1,000 situations where it's beneficial for the Widow to poison themselves.
If I was ever going to self-poison, I would then immediately announce that there was a Widow in play and I had seen the Widow token.
Yes, agreed.
I think the choice of who to poison, though, like, it's very script-dependent, obviously. But I do think that's interesting enough for me to put it in B tier, unlike Spy. I do think it's almost as weak as the Spy as a minion, if not weaker. But I do think it's more strategically interesting because of the choice of who you poison and what you and like the, how your playstyle changes based off what type of role you poison. Like,
if your goal is to
poison ongoing information, you want to stay as live as long as possible to get the most value out of that. If you want to poison to start knowing, you can then sacrifice yourself pretty quickly because the starts knowing has already been soaked up by your poison.
I think both of those choices also are extremely valid. I think poisoning a starts knowing, poisoning a once per game, that is a completely valid approach, poisoning an ongoing information role is also a valid approach. It's important to remember that the town is going to work out over the course of time who is widow poisoned, especially if it's an ongoing information role and you have your demon leave them alive for a while. It's also important to remember that when the widow dies, their poison goes away, which means that if you have poison in ongoing information role, that's the point at which that player needs to be dead when the widow poison goes away, in theory.
Yeah, you want them to die before you die, generally. And you don't, but the one thing you really don't want is for your demon to kill them as soon as you're dead, because that makes it very obvious that they were the widow poison.
You generally want to kill them before you die.
Yeah.
Or before you're figured out as the widow, rather.
Second to last of the minions we're going to talk about, and the last one we have image for, the final one, you'll just have to imagine, because we forgot to update this with the Boffin token, the witch. The witch is sort of the red-haired stepchild of S&B minions, in the sense that Pedag and Serenovus stand out because people love them, Evil Twin stands out because people hate them, and Witch kind of exists.
Wow, poor Witch. Because if you see somebody who is really good with the Witch and gets 2 or 3 kills in a game, boy is that powerful. That is fantastic acceleration, especially if you're not killing off demon candidates. That's important. You need to, once again, right, as we've talked about with a lot of these roles, you need to know who your demon candidates are so you're not cursing people who are demon candidates. If you're communicating with your demon and making it clear, hey, I'm going to go on these people, so, you know, you don't need to kill them because they're going to be cursed. If you have a great sense of kind of who might be nominating or can encourage people to nominate, you know, or kind of can trick people into nominating. Again, those are all kind of fun elements of which that sort of play into how you're going to use the ability with respect to the sort of choices that are available for you to make.
All that. It's a game accelerator. It needs to figure out both who is likely to nominate and who you don't mind dying to the witch, which sometimes are different things, and I think you should prioritize who you don't mind dying to the witch over who you think is likely to nominate. The demon candidate who's nominating every day, you probably have to soak your pride up and let them keep doing it with impunity, so that you can witch someone who you'd rather die. The witch also needs to think about when they want to frame people by having witch curses go off. Sometimes the worst thing for a witch is having witch curses continue to go off after someone who needs to be a witch in the world where your demon is good is dead. So you should try to avoid that most of the time, though.
Remember,
SMB, you're a little bit helped by the vigor mortis, meaning that dead people can still be the witch. Do consider, though, whether the person who needs to be framed as the witch to protect your demon is dead, and whether in that case you should start sinking your witch noms on, like, dead bodies.
Remember also that you can park your witch curse on dead bodies at any point, and then bring the witch ability back out if you want to hide witch for a while. If you've been unsuccessful, there's a lot of things you can do with it. Also, Emma mentioned when there's a demon candidate who keeps nominating and they don't die to a witch curse, you know, that's something where you don't want to put the witch curse on them. But a really good reason to not put the witch curse on them is because you know who else wouldn't be witch cursed? The demon. Since the demon wouldn't be witch cursed in that moment, it's okay for that person to keep nominating every day as a demon candidate and just not be witch cursed. That makes them look more like the demon. There's also some small value potentially in, and I don't know. I'm not usually a big fan of sort of self-cursing and killing yourself, but there's some small value maybe to be had in a self-curse. a lot of times it seems to get sussed out. Like, towns seem to snoop that out to some extent.
I think if you're going to go for the self-curse, you're almost always better off doing it early, where you can use it to, like, juice Vortox worlds rather than late.
Yeah. And I think you know, in a sense, it has some of the aspects of Fearmonger that make Fearmonger interesting, where once town knows it's there, it can create a sense of paranoia about making nominations. And so you might be able to intimidate town into, you know, subtly not making a lot of noms, keeping noms pretty limited. That can backfire as well if your demon is really suspicious, but you know, there's some availability, flexibility there.
Well, one thing I'd avoid doing is bluffing town crier as the witch. Yes. A lot of times people will meta that town criers are witches trying to encourage people to nominate. Mm-hmm. Just avoid it.
Yeah, I think it's not a great combination.
Witch has different choices, I think, than psychopaths and viziers. But I do think it sort of goes nicely thematically with the other game accelerators in B tier. And it also goes nicely thematically with the Fearmonger.
Yeah.
To an extent, it's like, because it sort of combines what the vizier and psychopath and Fearmonger do, maybe you could argue it goes higher. But I don't really think it does. I think it just slots in B tier with its siblings in the categories.
Yeah, I think it just goes nicely in the middle there. And when you see it do work, I mean, it does work. Unlike the Pit Hag and the Serenovus, which you see a lot on other scripts, the Witch really does a lot of work on SNV.
Yeah. You don't see the Witch on as many other scripts. Like I said, it's sort of the unloved child of SNV, the one no one cares about. It's not the one they love to hate or the ones they love. It's just the Witch.
It's just the Witch. But it's a damn good minion.
Mm-hmm. So our final minion is, of course, the Boffin. We don't have a token for it.
We'll put up an image here. we'll put up an image.
We'll figure one in the editing process. I think, unfortunately, the Boffin is going to end up... I love the Boffin. I think it really does interesting stuff for the game. But it's a minion whose entire ability is to give the demon more choices.
Yeah.
So the Boffin is, I think, strategically interesting for the evil team as a whole. I think for the Boffin player themselves, you just want to survive a few days to let your demon make use of the townsfolk ability. And once they've gotten the use out of it they need, you can probably just die whenever. Like, the storyteller's making your choice for you. The demon's making the choices with the ability. Do you sort of disagree with me here? Do you think the Boffin has any more sort of inherent depth to it? I think what I'm saying is, I think strategically, for the Boffin player, the Boffin's going to end up in C tier for me, unless Mill can convince me it belongs somewhere higher.
I think probably I don't think it belongs higher. I might argue that it belongs lower, but I do think it's an incredibly interesting minion, and I do think the ability to give the demon a townsfolk / outsider even ability is really, really interesting. There are a couple of, I just want to say like a couple of things about the Boffin in general, because I think it's interesting in play in a couple of different ways. The first is that there are just some abilities, there are just some townsfolk where the ability just doesn't really work great as something that the demon gets. Because it's not really providing any additional value. And an example of this that I'll give is the empath. The empath ability doesn't really tell you anything that you don't already know. It doesn't give the demon a whole lot extra. And so, for example, if a Boffin gives the demon the empath ability, they're really just giving them an extra bluff, which isn't very interesting. It might be interesting, though, that the Boffin player knows that bluff from the start and can take that as a bluff and hide to some extent. I don't think that's the intent of Boffin, but it might be a small like side effect that could be useful. However, if you are giving your demon a mechanical role that actually does something that might be confirmable, especially in the mid to late game, where it might prevent them from getting executed by the town, you want to make sure that your minion is, or that your demon, not the minion, is the one who is getting to claim that role and try to get that confirmation. Minions getting confirmed is not particularly useful. unless the demon can somehow pass their token onto that minion. And then the third piece of this, I think, which again isn't something that the boffin themselves does, is there are some roles that you don't actually need to claim are in play if you get them with the boffin ability. That you are sort of the opposite of something like empath. You don't want to use it as an extra bluff. You don't want the good team to know it's out there at all. A great example of this, I think, might be High Priestess, where the demon knowing who the best person for them to talk to each day is might be incredibly powerful, but not something that you want the town to know is out there. So don't just go running off as the boffin and start claiming the role that you saw. Have a conversation with your demon at some point, try to figure that out. You know, you've still got regular bluffs. If you just need a bluff, use a bluff. Don't use the boffin ability as a bluff unless you need to. So I think maybe there's a few different scenarios there that you can kind of think about what the boffin is doing and sort of how it functions and what the player should kind of claim and how those interactions should work. But I don't think it provides a substantial amount of choice, and I don't think there's a lot of significant depth there. So
yeah.
I think goes in C tier.
It creates overall strategic depth of the game for, I think, both the good team in fighting it and for how the demon chooses to use their boffin ability. It's just not very much on the minion itself. So I think for the purposes of this exercise, I think it's probably a C tier in terms of strategic depth for the minion, with the caveat that how the demon makes use of the townsfolk ability, how good fights the existence of the townsfolk, the possibility of the townsfolk ability existing, is quite powerful, interesting strategically. It's just not so for the boffin player. It's themselves particularly interesting.
I would agree completely. I think it goes in C tier. Happily, it's an interesting token, but there's just not that much you can do with it.
As the boffin.
I
want to be very clear, we're saying as the boffin.
The boffin is not doing a lot with it, yeah.
If I was ranking what this does for the strategic depth of the game in general, this would be much higher, possibly up there with the other S tier minions. But for the boffin player themselves, your choices are pretty limited.
And that's us making our way through the minions more or less completely. Quick once over, shall we?
So we have Summoner at the top of S tier because it makes the ultimate choice, the most strategic, the important choice the game could possibly allow. With it, we have the Goblin, the Baron, and the Poisoner. Now, something they all noticeably have in common is that they're all quiet. They leave very little evidence of themselves being in play.
In A tier, we have the Scarlet Woman, the Assassin, the Devil's Advocate, the Marionette, the Organ Grinder, and the Pit Hag. This is the tier of, I think, very versatile and flexible abilities that give you a lot of space to make choice and really impact the game with intention.
Mm-hmm. In the B tier, we have the Psychopath, Serenovus, Fearmonger, Witch, Godfather, Vizier, and Widow. These are all the characters that sort of... These are the game accelerators, the fear creators, the... which are all depth, all have depth, but are somewhat limited. In C tier, we have the Evil Twin, the Harpy, the Spy, and the Mastermind, all of which have some limited amount of... In the Boffin, all of which do a little bit, but mostly what they do is support other characters. And in the Harpy's case, I don't even know they really do that.
And then in D tier, we have the Mzephiles and the Boom Dandy, two characters that don't
really tunnel
choices.
You into like a yeah. single play pattern. Mez is, of course, give word, say word, give word, say word. Boom Dandy's is try your best to be executed day one, and then just sort of move on.
Then
with
please
your life.
Die. Yeah, then please die in the night, preferably.
Yeah. Day two is also a fine time to be executed as a Boom Dandy. Once you get to day three, day four, you're mostly just helping the good team.
Yeah, unfortunately you are.
To sort of preview what's coming up on the podcast. We are very sorry that we've been sort of away and negligent in posting episodes, and also of posting game content from the Twitch channel here. We are going to try to get back to both of those, obviously, this year listening to, so we've done that. Woo! The game channels, games, the actual plays are going to come back pretty soon, too. My guess is the next episode we'll do will be either our live decide. Recording from Vegas or one or two of back to our normal format. We are going to tackle definitely the demons and the outsiders in similar episodes to this because they're similar sized groups that we can get through in relatively the same speed.
Yep. Townsfolk is going to take a
Townsfolk
while.
Townsfolk is a much bigger group and it's going to take a while. So I would say, hopefully that we're going to get back into a more regular recording schedule. Milk's had some stuff in his personal life. I've had some stuff in my professional life that's really taken up a lot of our time in the past 2 months.
But like, we're more or less back.
We're more or less back, yeah. Like, so for those of you who don't know, I'm a lawyer by day, and in August of election years, I can sometimes get extremely busy because part of my practice involves representing, doing what's known as signature defense for initiatives in Arizona. So if you happen to have an initiative in Arizona, you want to hire me for the 2024 cycle, you should get in touch. I'd love to be hired by you. But the upshot of that was this August, I was basically only sleeping and working. Milk had some stuff in his personal life, which he can go into if he wants to, but my guess is he doesn't.
I don't mind sharing. My dad passed away after a 50-year battle with multiple sclerosis, which resulted in me spending the month of August, much like Emma, just being at my parents' house and caring for my dad and my mom. And now I'm moving and getting divorced. So a whole bunch of important and complicated stuff happening in my life as well. So, we're getting back to it.
Apologize for the lack of podcast episodes. Apologize for the lack of actual plays. Like I said, we're going to try to record at least one more episode before we go to Vegas. My guess will be a normal format episode, then we'll do the Vegas live show, then we'll come back and do the demons in a similar way, then we'll probably do a normal episode, then we'll do the outsiders, then we'll do a normal episode, and then we'll figure out how we want to grapple with all the townsfolk.
Yeah, it's a lot.
We did not expect minions to take two episodes to cover, and I don't know if you know this, but there's about three times as many townsfolk as there are minions or outsiders or demons.
Maybe we can group them differently, Emma. We'll figure it out.
So we may have like six townsfolk episodes broken up by lots of normal episodes.
Maybe we'll do all the You Start Knowing and see how it goes.
But anyway, hope to see you all in Vegas. By the time you're listening to this, tickets to DC ClockCon Final 3 Con, we're not supposed to call it ClockCon anymore. They don't have a license to use the trademark anymore. Final 3 Con tickets will have gone on sale already, so if they're still available, please go buy them. We'll be there. Save a Night has also been promoted as a Grim Scenarios content partner, which I'm really excited for. Save a Night getting the recognition he deserves. So he'll be there as an official content partner as well. A bunch of other awesome people will be there, but I did want to shout out how awesomely excited I am for Jay Fry. To be promoted as a official content creator partner.
Get them fried!
Along with me and Milk.
And with that, I think we're just about done here. To all of you out there, thanks for sticking with us. May your scenarios stay grim, everyone.